muffins, and a seasonal selection of pies, cakes, and more.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Today in this portion of the program, a conversation about creativity with writer and photographer Jan Phillips. Jan Phillips is the author of Marry Your Muse, Making a Lasting Commitment to Your Creativity. Jan Phillips' work has appeared in the New York Times, Christian Science Monitor, and Utney Reader. Her book, Marry Your Muse, is based on workshops first sponsored by the International Women's Writing Guild. As we talk, I hope you'll join us, share your thoughts about muses and creativity. Your questions are also welcome. Here are the phone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Jan Phillips' book, Marry Your Muse, is published by Quest Books. And again, our telephone numbers, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Jan Phillips, good afternoon. Welcome.
Why, thank you.
The title, Marry Your Muse, Making a Lasting Commitment to Your Creativity. What does it mean to make a commitment to one's creativity?
Well, I think that it's easy for us to understand making a commitment to a person that we love, making a commitment to something in the world that's tangible and real. But for us to really make a commitment to our creativity, it really means bringing the intangibles forward so that we create. Say, for example, to commit to my creativity means that I bring to that relationship something vital and important, like my time, like a certain space in which I work, like a certain belief in the importance and the value of this work. So if we don't make a commitment to our creativity, then we're very apt to ignore it, you know, to let it fall by the wayside, because there's not a lot of support in the world for our creative gestures and activities.
Hmm. How did you come to this understanding of creativity, that it you need to honor it, you need to have time for it, make time for it?
I never really perceived myself as a creative person because it was never part of my growing up. I went to Catholic school, so there was never any art classes. I went into the convent after high school. There was never a lot of, there was not much stress on creativity. In fact, it was kind of looked upon as a self-indulgent activity. And so all of my life, I never really realized I was creative until I looked back, like around the age of 40, and saw my body of work. You know, saw that I had created all these songs, or I had these huge photographic exhibitions that were created out of nothingness, basically out of the way I was seeing in the world. And I had made a journey around the world as a kind of peace activist slash artist. And out of that journey came a book, the first book that was ever published, called Making Peace: One Woman's Journey in the World. So as a result of those activities, I looked back and I thought, oh my goodness, I am a creative person. Because I always had this little niche that I put artists in, which, you know, it's like they were bohemians, they lived in Greenwich Village, they did weird things, they wore weird clothes, they wore, you know, berets. It was like this very old-fashioned little concept of artists. And when I finally said, oh my goodness, I'm an artist, then that's at the same time I got hooked up with this Writers Guild. And I said, because I had just had my book published, and I went to the director of the Writers Guild and said, can I do a writing workshop? Well, sure, she says, what would you like to title it? I said, I don't know. How about Marry Your Muse? because it just came like a fluke, like all of our art comes. You know, it just came bubbling up like some spring mountain stream. And so I developed this workshop, and we had 6 days together, and the women came in, and some of them said, I don't even know what's a muse? You know, they never really they didn't have a visualization or a concept of the word muse. And so we began to talk about the muse, and then women began to say not what they were creating, but all the reasons why they were creating. It was incredible. We came there, and the first few days, we were just saying, these are the obstacles. And at first, it was like, easy to understand things. I don't have the time. I don't have the space in which to work. I don't have, you know, my husband and my kids don't leave me alone. I can't work without being interrupted. And then it got into the deeper, more troublesome issues, like, I don't have faith in myself. I don't believe that what I create will be a contribution. I think it's a waste of my time. I should be serving others. I should be more selfless. And all these, like, concerns came up. And so at the end of the week, we actually had a commitment ceremony. We married our muses, and we brought to the table our commitments. And each woman's commitment was very different based on what her personal obstacle was. But we turned it around. We turned our obstacles into possibilities for us. We kind of reframed what was troubling us. And the commitments that day were just amazing commitments. And these women write to me. I see them every year at this conference, and they're talking about their muse, and they're, you know, it's like their muses have names and clothing and hairstyles, and their muse. And all of us know that the muses are really ourselves by now, because we've done that inner work. But in the beginning, we really had to, you know, reach out and see it as a form outside of ourselves, because we weren't able to believe in our own possibilities in the early stages.
That's something that you ask readers to do right up front in Marry Your Muse. Imagine the muse not as a force above and beyond, but within.
Yeah, because, you know, we're so taught, at least this is kind of in the Judeo-Christian tradition, we're so taught to believe that great power is outside of ourselves. And I remember when I was just kind of getting in touch with my muse, kind of really identifying seeing it as a real force that I collaborated with. I named her. She named herself. Her name was Rebecca, and we wrote songs together. And one time, I was making a tape of my songs, and I was singing this song that I had kind of collaborated on with Rebecca, and it says, one of the lines is, the God that you're seeking needs not to be sought. You're already one, like the sea and the salt. And the guy who was the pianist on this tape I was making slammed his hands down on the piano, and he said, stop, this is heresy. He says, you're singing heresy, and I'm not going to participate in this. And it took us quite a long time to work through that, because he was convinced I was being blasphemous by saying that we contain God within us, that all that great power that we thought belonged to this big man with a beard was really as much within us as outside of us. And so one has to be very careful. I've tried to be very careful in this book not to be so bold and arrogant and to say it in such a way that I'm sounding like a heretic. All I'm saying is that great, vast, wonderful spiritual power that we have accessed over the generations is also inside of us. It's like there's no barriers between us and God. So that's like the source of our art. And I think my approach to our creativity and our art making is slightly different from maybe the average approach, because I look upon art, the act of creating, as a sacramental activity. That it's like when you take time to go to do your creative work, it's every bit as important as taking time for prayer. And so that's why you have the right to say to people, do not disturb me now. Nobody walks into somebody in a church who's on their knees and starts having a conversation about lunch. You know, it's like going, having a bubble bath. Nobody should be allowed to be disturbed during a bubble bath or your prayer, you know. And so for women particularly, I think the main audience for this book is women, because we've been so conditioned to try and be selfless and to really put our own personal needs on hold. And look, we are the creators of the universe. We're creating, we're peopling the earth, and that's just the beginning of it. You know, there's tons of manifestations of the great, wonderful power, the power of the mysteries, you know, that all need to be translated into other art forms like poems or songs or dance or our potteries, our sculptures. We all have different ways of saying it, you know. My sister does it through crochets and cooking, through decorating her house. You know, it's like all of us do it in different ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you write, all of us are creative. To say otherwise, that's blasphemy.
Mm-hmm.
You also have a lot to say about creativity and how it gives us energy. I think that's an interesting way to think about creativity. You want to talk with us about that idea?
I think that the act of creating, if one approaches it like it's really an act of alchemy. Because what we're really doing is we're tuning into a higher frequency. We're really first, you don't just like sit down in the middle of a highway and start a poem. Really, the poem, a line of the poem occurs to us first. You know, there's like some inspiration for the piece sparks our imagination first. And so what we do then is, once we hear that chord that's part of the song we're making, or once we get that line of the poem, then we really settle into it. And we really go down to be with that thing. And by going down, I just mean removing ourselves from the chaos of our daily lives. And so when we make that gesture of being with this thing, creating is not something that it's not like we have to make up something from scratch and it's a hard, laborious thing. Creating is just like finding a way for us to open the gates for this thing that already exists to get out. You know, the poem already lives inside us. We just have to figure out how to be quiet enough and open enough and trusting enough to let it come on out, you know, and write itself. And that process of removing ourselves from the chaos of the world and really going to a place of silence, not that we don't create with music. I often have music around just to assist my emotions in fully expressing themselves. But it's in a self-determined silence. It's like in a void. We go there and we create. In that act of collaborating with the spirit, in that act of letting this creation wander around and find its way out of our bodies, that is such an energizing act, because it's unlike anything in the world. It's unpredictable. It's magnificent. You end up with something that didn't exist before, that came up out of you, that you don't even know what you had to do with, except you shaped it with your hands or your pen or your at the piano. But it's like a magical activity, and nobody can experience that kind of magic without being energized by it.
Mm. At one point in your life, you talk about this a little bit in the book, and you've mentioned it here in the interview. At one point in your life, you were in the novitiate, studying to become a sister.
Mm-hmm.
Something I find very, I don't know, kind of amusing, I suppose. You were asked to leave. You were told you didn't have a religious disposition.
Mm-hmm.
That's hard for me to believe. I mean, there is a lot of passion and religion in you, I think.
I think there's a big distinction between religion and spirituality. And religious, to me, is about dogma. It's about the letter of the law. And spirituality is about the spirit of the law. It's about freedom. It's about going beyond the law because your relationship with God, or whatever you call God, is so enthralling and so captivating that you have your own conscience about things. And so what troubled them in the community was that I was so on fire with my own stuff that the pettiness of their rules just was like, are you kidding? Meditate at 5 o'clock? Why meditate at a certain hour when I have more energy at 2? You know, it's like I wanted to make up my own rules that fit my own spirituality. Yeah. Plus, I was way too passionate for them. You know, they're trying to keep one's passions down because at that age, you know, passions have a lot, could lead to sensuality, could lead to sexuality, could lead to, big trouble in the convent. And they were very frightened of my relationships with people because I was so loving and intimate, and I'm sure that frightened them. And so it was much easier for them to let me go and just say, no, she's too strong of a character for us right now. So that's what they did. They just, you know, called my mom and said, come fetch her because we just can't deal with her. And for me it was traumatizing because since I was 12, that's all I wanted to be in the world because it was a nun that changed my life. And so I thought, oh, that means I can change someone else's life if I'm a nun. But what I didn't realize was it wasn't the garment, it wasn't that habit that I needed. It were those habits. It was those habits of prayer and solitude and service in community. That's what I spent 2 years in the convent to learn, that those were the elements I needed to be magnificent in the world, to be creative. It takes those same habits to be creative. And that's what took me the last 30 years to realize. I didn't know this until I was in the middle of writing this book, that, oh my goodness, that's why I went into the convent, to see what habits I needed. And those four elements, if one of them is gone from my life, I'm a mess. If I don't have prayer time, if I don't have solitude, if I don't give service to my community, and if I don't have a larger community that I'm a part of doing something bigger than myself, my life falls apart.
Mm.
And so for me, making art in the world, my art making is always my prayer. You'll notice in the book, there's tons of prayers through the book, but I think the ideal life is a life in which how we live our daily lives, everything I do, every gesture I make in the world, if that's like a personalization of my inner prayers, if I'm really living out and acting out what I pray about when I wake up in the morning, then my creations are beautiful. Every action I make is a wonderful gesture.
Hmm. So what happened when you were 12, when a nun touched your life, changed you? What happened?
I was very shy, and I didn't believe in myself, and I thought I was not smart, and I had no friends. I had no faith in myself, and I was very insecure. And this nun recognized something inside me. So she went to my mother, and it was in the early 60s, and there was this new phenomenon, what was it called, positive reinforcement. So her and my mother go on this campaign, unbeknownst to me, we're going to practice positive reinforcement on your daughter. And so this nun, she really singled me out, which was, I think, unfair to the rest of the class now that I look at it. But she was determined to bring me out of my shell. And so what she did was always say, Jan Phillips, you're the best writer. You come up here and write the class notes on the board. You write like you have a ruler on the end of your nose. Jan Phillips, you're such a good athlete. You make one of the best cheerleaders in class. Jan Phillips, you're strong and you're cute and you're smart. And over and over and over, she'd say these things. And I started staying after class and helping her do the bulletin boards. And she would always say to me the beautiful, strong things about myself. And at first I thought, this nun is really stupid because doesn't she know I'm not smart and I'm not any of these things that she says I am? But eventually she said them so often that I started to believe them. And once I started to believe them, I came out of my shell. But I had the consciousness of the underdog. I had the familiarity of what it feels like not to belong. So I hung with those kids that didn't belong. But all the while, I was being seen more and more as a leader in my class. So when we had class elections for president and vice president and all those offices, every single ballot that got handed in, every vote except one, which is my own, was for me. And so when the woman, so the nun, Sister Helen Charles, counted all the votes, and she goes, "Oh, my God, Jan Phillips got every vote but one." But I couldn't be president because girls couldn't be president, so she let me be treasurer or secretary or one of those things. But I ran all the way home, a mile. I ran a mile home and called my, and said to my mom, "Mom, Mom, they finally think I'm okay. The kids think I'm okay." And it was like the moment of metamorphosis in my life. Mm. So I thought I had to be a nun in order to be able to do that for someone else. Well, little did I know.
It was there, though, I think, that you really hit on an appreciation of community and solitude. And although you say that you struggled with actually finding solitude and carving out that space, you struggled with that for a long time.
Oh, it was just impossible. I come out, it's 1969. In the 2 years I'd been in the community, a lot had gone on. There was like the sexual liberation movement was going on. The, you know, drug, sex, and rock and roll was going on. Miniskirts were happening. I was like, oh my, I felt like I was walking into the Twilight Zone. I couldn't fit into that culture. And I didn't know how to, I kept going, try to go to churches so I could just like get away from all this noise and all this irreverence that I was felt in the midst of. But the churches had started being locked, and so I couldn't even go into churches. And I didn't know really how could I make a church for myself. So I tried to practice by having my bedroom then be my church, but I would close my door. But nobody knew how to interpret it when I would say, "I'm going in to say my prayers." That was about the stupidest thing they could ever hear. And so they just would laugh and not take me seriously. So the phone ring would be for me. I'd be in there in the midst of, you know, trying to make a poem or make a prayer or just be just whatever I was doing in those precious moments. And they come knocking on the door saying, "Phone's for you." You know, my mom, you know, my brothers and sisters or people that I lived with in over the next 10 and 20 years, it's like people have a very hard time getting it that a person has a right to silence. A person has a need for silence and how to honor that. And I mean, when you live in households with two and three and five different people, it was almost impossible for me to communicate to them because they would scratch their heads and say, "What do you mean, you know, pray? Or what do you mean you need to be alone to create?" It's like nobody really ever got it. So, you know, eventually I started living alone.
Well, that's a very practical approach. That's a very creative solution. Mm-hmm. You write that you went back and forth then with those interruptions between, you know, sort of feeling angry at people knocking at your door and feeling selfish for wanting.
Oh, absolutely. I felt selfish for decades because it took so long for me to understand that this work, that these, my creations, whether it's making photographs or writing songs or writing books or screenplays, any creation that I involve myself in or that any other person in the world involves themselves in, that is a contribution to the world. Imagine trying to live in this world without the art that we're surrounded by. Imagine not having those paintings on your walls. Imagine having no books in your bookshelves or no music to listen to. It would be such a terrible life. But all those artists that made those books and those paintings and that music, those artists all had to demand time alone and time for themselves and to be uninterrupted in order to accomplish those works of art. And we're the same. You know, it's every bit as important for me as it was for Michelangelo or Da Vinci or, you know, Louisa May Alcott or Emily Dickinson. And someday what I create may be on someone else's shelves, and my words are helping them along in their lives. It's we pass it on. I mean, the classics will always be classics, but God forbid we're not still creating classics as we go along in the 90s. You know, I hope to leave behind some classics that people pay attention to 300 years from now. And I deserve the time it takes to do that, because it's not self-indulgent. It's an act of faith. I'm believing myself through all these doubts that what I put down, that what passes through me in this world and what I leave behind. I have no children, but I am leaving behind a multitude of living things.
Hmm. Jan Phillips is our guest. We're talking with her this afternoon about creativity. Jan Phillips has written a book that is kind of a do-it-yourself course, a way of reflecting on creativity. The book is titled Marry Your Muse, Making a Lasting Commitment to Your Creativity. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call in Champaign-Urbana, the number 333-9455. Anywhere else you're listening, call us toll-free, the toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. In an earlier chapter, we've been talking about solitude and the importance of that. In an earlier chapter, you kind of remind us that we have this kind of warped idea of time, that we realize it's so precious, but yet we fail to spend any of that resource on ourselves. What are we missing?
Well, time is the only thing that we can bring to the table. That's all we have. People always say, I don't have any time, they say. I don't have any time, and I go, oh my God, time is all we have. Time is all we have. I mean, our lives are what time that we're given. I have one short lifetime to leave behind something that says, this is how Jan Phillips saw the world. I have one short lifetime to make it known in the world who I am, what I saw, what I noticed along the way. And I think the problem is that we've really associated time, we've put a value on time based on, if we spend our time doing something that makes money, it's time well spent. If we spend our time on something that doesn't make money, it's a waste of time. And I think this is like the major mistake of our culture, that we have so misunderstood what time is in our lives. Because, well, I didn't even realize how much I had taken that in myself, except for one time when I was in India, and I was at this Gandhian ashram, and they were building a barn, and the barn site was about a mile away from where this stream went by, and they had to get the materials for the mortar from the stream. And so there was a line of about 85 people that snaked through the fields and up these hills and up a ladder, and it was like all these people standing a few feet apart from each other, passing bowls that they up from the stream bed where they picked up little bowls full of like pebbles and sand and water, and they passed these bowls about a mile, you know, through these fields and meadows over to the barn site where they were mixing up the mortar for the barn. And this is in monsoon season. It's like over 100 degrees. And I'm looking around saying 85 people are spending all these hours passing these silly bowls, you know, from one person to another, all this distance. And I look around and I see over in one part of the field there's two tractors sitting there not doing anything. And I notice these two carts over in another part of the field, and then these two kids walk by with these oxen that they're taking down to the river. And I said to the woman next to me, she was an English-speaking Hindu woman, and I said, this is so stupid. Why are we spending all of our time, all these people handing these bowls, it's 100 degrees out, and why don't we just like hook up these oxen to the cart and use these tractors and, you know, get it done efficiently? Don't you know time is money? And when I said, as soon as I, even before those words got out of my mouth, I looked at her face and she was looking horrified and I was feeling horrified because I thought, then I knew what an ugly American was. And I knew I should just kneel down and apologize. And, you know, she put her little bowl down and she came over. She was so polite. She put her hand on my arm, and she said to me, "If you only knew how important it is for these people to be passing these bowls, because then they can bring their children here and their grandchildren here, and they can say that their sweat went into making this barn. And when this barn is built, they're going to know it was built because of them." And she said, "If you don't understand that, then you have a lot to learn about India."
Hmm.
And it was like through that experience, I suddenly noticed that I had a wrong version of time. You know, I had been miseducated about the importance of time in our lives. And it was my 3 months in India that really helped me understand what's up about time. You know, what's just a lot of baloney that we've been taught. And I think the worst thing we've been taught is that if our activities don't lead to profit and money, then those activities are a waste of time. Because 90% of us who are creating anything in this world are not going to be seeing a lot of profit from it. The profit is not in money. The profit is in the difference that it makes in the world. You know, the difference that your poem makes to me, when I see how you've translated your experience into a poem or a piece of art, and that touches me, that's the profit. You know, that's the difference, because your life has had an impact on my life. You know, your light has shone in my darkness, and that's what counts for success. And that's the value of our creativity. Who cares if I make 1 cent off this book? I didn't write this book to make money. In fact, I didn't even go to see if I could sell this book until it was finished, because I knew myself. If I took it out there and the publishers started rejecting it, that I wouldn't finish it, because I'm not strong enough to keep believing in something. And I knew. I mean, the real title of this book is Things I Don't Want to Forget by Jan Phillips. I knew I was writing this book for myself and for those women that were in my first Marry Your Muse class. I'm writing for them. I'm writing for the people that are short on confidence, that really want to contribute something, that really want to transform their experience into some other art form. But nobody's out there saying, "Go, girl, you can do it. Yes, you're worth this.
No.
Yes, it's important what you do." So that's who I'm writing for.
Sister Helen Charles.
Exactly.
We've got some callers waiting to talk with us. We'll go first to a caller on line one in Champaign. Hi.
Hi. I'm very interested in what you're saying. And I was wondering, do you still have these workshops?
Yes, I still have these workshops. In fact, I'm doing one in Kalamazoo and one in Mishawaka, Indiana, and a couple in Wheaton, outside of Chicago, coming up over the next week and a half.
Oh, I'd be interested in some information on that. Would it be find it in your book, or would you give that over the phone?
Maybe at the end of the program, I'll give the information over the phone, so anyone that wants to go to these workshops will know how to make the connection.
How to get more information.
Yeah, it's good to read, but sometimes if you're there together with other people, it makes it even better.
Oh, the workshops I know, it's like a Pentecost. Everyone just comes afire. It's great.
Great.
So, yeah, so stay tuned. Listen to the rest of the program. We'll tell you numbers at the end.
Okay, thanks so much.
Okay.
Thanks for your call this afternoon. Our next caller is on line 4 near Denison. Hi.
Hello, John. Mm-hmm. Hello, John. This is Carl. I was very much struck by your statement that your pianist accompanist declared that you were being a heretic.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that struck me because I am very much aware of what you're trying to get at, creativity, and it comes from within. And the basis for this is Luke, 17th chapter, 24th verse, where what Jesus says, behold, the kingdom of God is within you.
Mm-hmm.
That's the secret of the whole thing.
There you go. Yeah, this is heaven.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for your call this afternoon. Other calls are welcome. Our guest, Jan Phillips, she's the author of Marry Your Muse, Making a Lasting Commitment to Your Creativity. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. If you'd like to talk with us, give us a call. 333-9455 is the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else you're listening, call toll-free 1-800-222-9455. You tell a story in the book about going to a workshop or a seminar or something designed to help artists make a living through their creativity, and you asked a question of the panel, the experts, about approaching editors with your work in two media, writing and photography.
This was terrible. This was a panel for freelance photographers, and there was five or six different picture editors from very important mainstream magazines and newspapers there. All the people who decide whether or not our photographs are going to get into their publications. And so it was like the gold mine. And we had, there was about 400 of us photographers in the audience. So they let us have our questions. And I thought I had a bright question. And mine was, I was often confused about who to pitch my story to, since I'm a writer and a photographer, and my stories always include photographs, so should I pitch the story to the photo editor or the article editor? And even before I got my question out, they're up there, every panel member's up there just looking at me like I was some bozo brain. They're rolling their eyes, and they have these exasperated looks on their faces. And finally, one of them said, oh, I'll take it. And he answered my question in this way. He goes, not only can you not be a writer and a photographer, you have to be a photographer who specializes in one thing, he goes. Like, we've got our fashion photographers, our dog photographers, our automobile photographers. And that's who we go to. We don't go to just somebody who generalizes. And nobody can nobody can be a writer and a photographer. And I felt that redness you feel that rushes up when you're so embarrassed. I just felt like this country bumpkin in the palace. And I was humiliated. And I just felt like, first of all, I believed them. And so I left the room because I was so embarrassed. And I walked down the long hall to the ladies' room. And by the time I got to the ladies' room, I'm thinking, what should I be? What should I photograph? Dogs or cars? Or I knew I couldn't be a fashion photographer. But then, by the time I got my senses back, I realized that my question was changing from what do I have to do to please them to what do I have to give and how do I want to give it? And so I just decided I'm not participating in this anymore, that I won't be a freelance photographer if those are the rules, because I don't like those rules, and so I'll find some other way to make my way in the world, which really freed me up a lot, because it's a hard thing being a freelance photographer. You feel like you're a monk out there with your begging cup. But I felt how short-sighted when I finally thought about it. I thought, can you imagine somebody saying to Michelangelo, you can only work in one medium, so that we would have to choose between David and the Sistine Chapel? Imagine that short-sightedness. And God, these people are the picture editors for the foremost magazines in the country. And they are that shallow and that short-sighted to think that a person cannot write well and photograph well. These are the limitations that are putting us in straitjackets. It's pathetic, isn't it?
That's pretty sad. It's in a way, it's stunning to run across that attitude. In another way, I suppose it's not surprising. But it's It really is. It really is amazing. So eventually, though, you Marry Your Muse is your second book, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you've had work in the New York Times and the Christian Science Monitor.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you would talk with us about the work that you've done for those publications, and the subjects or themes you especially like to explore, and the goals you have in your work.
Well, it seems that I'm always on the margins. And so I'm always looking for stories or images that say something about that which is rarely reflected in this culture. So for example, the photograph that was in the New York Times was a photograph of there was a fraternity on the campus at Syracuse University that had manufactured these T-shirts, which were very anti-gay. They were homophobic T-shirts, and they had terrible expressions on them and real bad imagery and stuff. And the fraternity just put them out in the world and didn't suffer any repercussions because of it. And so there was a group on campus that really like took that on as a cause and kind of used it to highlight the dangers of homophobia in this society. And so I was there on campus. I was doing grad work at the time, and so I just went and took some photographs of the T-shirts. So that got included in the New York Times, which is a bit of a coup, but that didn't have anything to do with me pitching a story to the New York Times. That was like serendipitous. But the story I did for the Christian Science Monitor was one I really loved, because I took off on this trip in 1990 across the country. It was just me and my little Honda, and I decided to go drive across the country and only go to small towns and villages and talk to people about their faith and their values and how where they got their values from and how they're still living them out and what matters to them and this and that. And so I went all the way through the South. Dear, that was a trip. Through the South, through the Bible Belt, through the Midwest, the Southwest, and into California and back home. And I interviewed all these people. And so the article in the Christian Science Monitor was this really broad, expansive look at the commonness that we have as a human family. Basically, we all pretty much are in agreement when it comes down to the basic elements about what we stand for, what we're committed to, what we want in life, and I learned some really incredible lessons. And in fact, I had this one really wonderful experience with this old man. I was in this house in Kentucky, and there was an 88-year-old guy named Arthur who lived in this house. And when I walked into the house, I saw that his coffee table was filled with literature that was very propagandist against. It was John Birch literature, was like all this anti-communist, anti-peace, it was very militaristic, kind of anti-gay, anti-everything. And I was so affronted by the literature that I thought I didn't dare meet the man, because he was definitely, he would consider me his enemy. And so one day I met him. And I said to him, well, this is what I'm doing. I'm going around and I'm interviewing people about their values and stuff. And he says, come outside. And he was very stern and stuff. And he walked with a cane. We walked around his land, and he had been in lumber all his life. He had a lumber business. And he took his cane and he pointed up at this big tree. And he says, what force is loose in this world that can in a short span of time manufacture or create this kind of nut, this walnut here, or whatever nut it was? And he goes, it's so strong I can't even crack it open with my cane. And he goes, what force is loose in the world that'll take one little seed of corn and over the season create an ear that's got hundreds and hundreds of those corns and these beautiful tassels and this and that? And he just walked around the land, and he talked about the earth and the power of nature in such a way that it brought me to my knees, practically. And he talked about his love for trees so much. And so I said to him, And I was falling in love with Arthur, this 88-year-old man, who I thought was my enemy 24 hours earlier because of what I thought he believed politically, you know. And so after I would stay there for a week, and Arthur and me, like, just fell in love with each other and walked everywhere together. And so when I went on my journey, every time I came to a place where there was postcards of trees, I wrote to him and I just said, "Dear Arthur," because he told me his one-time dream in the world was to go see the sequoia trees in the redwoods in Yosemite. And I would send him this postcard with the trees on it, and I'd say, "Dear Arthur, get to Yosemite before it's too late. Love, Jan."
Yeah.
So I kept sending him all these postcards. And then I get home. I was like out on the road for 3 months, and I get home and I see this postcard with all these trees on it from him. And it says, "Dear Jan, I'm in Yosemite. The trees are so beautiful, they make me cry. Thanks. Love, Arthur."
Yeah.
You know, it's like those are the things that happen when we, like, let go of our biases and our prejudices and just plain talk to each other.
Mm.
We fall in love with each other.
We're here at the end of the time we can spend together today, Jan. And before we go, let's give folks a little information here about Mirror Your Muse workshops.
Okay, a workshop in Kalamazoo is at the Portage Public Library. And the phone number, the contact to sign up for the workshop is 616-692-2435. There's a book signing at the John Rollins Bookstore there in Kalamazoo. The workshop in that workshop is from 10 to 4 on January 10th. The workshop in Mishawaka, Indiana is at 7 o'clock on Tuesday the 12th. And the phone number to contact about that one, I mean, that's 7 to 9 on the January 13th, on the 13th, Wednesday the 13th. The phone number is 219-259-6996.
Okay, and the Wheaton?
And the workshops at the Theosophical Society are on January 15th, and there's an all-day workshop on January 17th, and you could call Quest Books in Wheaton, Illinois, to find out about that, or the Theosophical Society. I'm sorry, I don't have that phone number.
Okay,
right here.
I have that. And tell you what we'll do is what we'll do here is we need to move along and find out what happened.